This is KBOO Portland. The time is 6 o'clock.
Voice of the Middle East. South of Sharq al-Awsat min Izaat Kaibu. Wa sidai khabar miyane az radio KBOO.
Talluh babna talluh nasibya Bain rubu'ana khalbu Tahkit zaharat jwani Talluh babna talluh nasibya Bain rubu'ana khalbu فيات غنينا وعلى ميا لقينا على أقصى ما حلو من زاد الطير الشاي نحن حكايات في بال مننا.
Good evening and welcome to another installment of Voices of the Middle East on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. We also on ether around the Southwest Washington and Gorge and the Willamette Valley. This is Gudarz Ektidari, your host. Last month, our program was preempted for the homeless marathon that we were broadcasting on Thursday. And tonight, I have some recordings of a conference that was actually at Portland State University but did not get much of attention from mainstream media in Portland. And my understanding is that even though Middle East Studies Center and International Studies at Portland State sent out press releases and they even arranged for a special meeting with Oregonian editorial staff, nothing was really published on that symposium, which was a whole-day symposium on U.S.-Saudi Arabia relation. There were quite a few scholars from universities in Saudi Arabia and their counterparts at Portland State who participated in the program. And several of scholars who attended the conference were actually women who had studied in Oregon. One of them, I believe, was graduate of Portland State, and the other one, graduate of Oregon State and University of Oregon. So three ladies who came back to Oregon, they were a part of the participant of the symposium. And in addition to the Saudi guests, there were several distinguished scholars and professors of Portland State University who participated in discussions. And tonight, one of the basically coordinators of that symposium, Dr. John Mandeville, will join this program and this discussion. But to begin with, actually, since last week was also International Women's Day, I would invite you to listen to a piece that's been interviewed with Dr. Henda Khotela, She is a professor at Education University, College of Education, King Saud University, Dr. Hind Al-Khutayla. In her talk at the symposium was titled The Saudi Woman and the Western Media. And in the interview, I actually asked her to begin talking about the level of education and involvement of women in civil participation in Saudi Arabia. And this is Dr. Khutayla.
There are thousands of women that they carry doctorate degrees in different fields, and they hold a leadership position in the field of education, economics, and we're hoping other fields will follow.
Actually, it was very impressive the presence of several academic female professionals in this symposium who were obviously educated in the U.S. and then you went back and tried to serve your community and the society as well. But the question, and your presentation actually in symposium was about the role of women and how it's being perceived by Western media. Can you elaborate on that and give our audience a chance to hear what you said in summary about how women are being perceived in the West?
It is very important that if there is any culture differences or differences in interest that will be overbridged, and to the main thing that we maintain our relation as the nations, and especially it's with the globalization, the relation of Saudi Arabia and United States is very, very crucial to be maintained in the positive level. And a lot of the media mispresent the women role in a way that they attack a woman in a very sensitive issues like cultural things. Why you're wearing abaya? Why you don't drive? Why you don't? You know, I just don't like the question why, because I just feel that I'm under the, there is something behind the question. But if it would be presented in a way how we understand your culture, how we build understanding to the history of your culture, so we can strengthen our understanding and in a very continuous way, then I would accept that. But wearing abaya is part of my culture. Never stopped me of coming to the United States when I finished high school and I was 15 years old. And my family, when my father approved my coming to the United States, the whole the rest of the family were very upset and fighting the decision, and I was protected of my government, and even I was praised to be giving a scholarship. Just the minute they heard that my father really approved me coming here to study. And what happened is after a while there was approval of me coming here, because I did not they thought this might affect my my identity, or affect my, or they're afraid that I will melt in the culture of the United States. But I graduated, I came back, I participated in my country, and this has changed the whole idea, and it was accepted. And just a year later, a lot of my cousins were sending their daughters to study in the United States, and really, there is a lot of. It was a very crucial decision then, not only to my family but the whole nation. And it's really influenced my life in a very highly positive way. And now, after all these years, I came back in a position that I have to stand for what to cultivate what was seeded. And I was received by American culture and American family. American universities, campuses were very generous with me, were very knowledgeable for me, and they open a warm heart for me by all means and aspects. And now I feel in our symposium that I have to pay some of what I've gained. And this is something really we have to stand for, and we should really work to continue understanding each other and respecting each other and maintain the relationship in the highest positive way we can think. It's very important to know a little bit about Saudi Arabian culture. Women work really in a very humble way, and it is it's very recommended that when you serve, when you do your duties, when you serve your country, when you serve your society, you should not propagandize it, and you should not advertise it. And so it's part of our culture that we're away from the media. And but language of the century has been changed, and now we're paying a lot of effort to get ourselves to learn this media language, to be under the media, the eye of the media. And this is, it takes a lot of our guts, and it takes a lot of our courages, and they're always. But women always are very active with her society. There is women, Saudi women teachers, doctorate, specialized professor in many, many fields. Women really have equal opportunity in education, equal opportunity in jobs, equal opportunity in promotions. The thing is, if there is any barriers, it's cultural barriers. And it needs a willpower of the society themselves to do any changes toward that. But it doesn't mean that women are not taking her rights equally with men, and we really don't have to fight even more. Like if my students all take encouragement allowance to just go to college, where is this in any way in the world? They take a monthly salary just to go to college. They're provided with free transportation. They're provided with free books. They're provided with meals. Also, dormitories, accommodation, free, just to go to college, and all levels of higher education, education, and this is something really it's a privilege for women, and we really appreciate it. But in the meanwhile, we still have some. we need to work on the file of the value of women, how she carry herself, how she deals with herself, and it's only her decision and how she carries herself within the society. So I think it's a matter of time that she needs to orient herself to handle herself in a very confident way to bridge this social kind of changes, and it's a matter of changes procedures that we need to just go over it. And I hope that the other Western media will understand this and become supported instead of attacker. So that we really need this great opportunity, and we both are in the same boat, and we need a lot of willpower and understanding and initiative, and we feel it. We feel it in the warmth of how we are welcomed and how we are really hosted.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, I was talking to Dr. Henda Al-Khatela, a professor of education at King Saud University. She was attending a symposium that was put together by Poland State University and King Saud University at Poland State in January 26th. And tonight with me is Dr. John Mandeville, professor of history and Middle East studies, a distinguished scholar of Ottoman history, and also an expert on peninsula. And it's a pleasure to have you here, Dr. Mandeville. Welcome.
Thank you, Godars. It's good to be back.
Let's talk a little bit about the symposium, and maybe in short, can you tell me what was the reason for having this event put together by Poland State, and what really encourages you to continue with bringing scholars from Middle East and opening up a forum for them to speak to the people directly here?
Well, we're always interested at the Middle East Studies Center at Portland State University in bringing scholars from that region. And it seemed pretty obvious following 9/11 and everything that fell out from it, in particular an increasing chorus of dislike for Saudi Arabia reflected in our press and in the media in general, that there was a good deal of misunderstanding in the land. So we decided to follow through by inviting one or two faculty, and that turned into, as you know, something like 16 or 18 of them, all from King Saud University. And we're very fortunate in two respects in this. Among the faculty, four of them are members of the Majlis al-Shura, which is the advisory council, the equivalent of Saudi Arabia's proto-parliament, I guess is the way to put it. And also among them were six, I think, total, although they didn't all speak, women faculty. So we had a very good cross-section, and we had a very good dialogue that came out of it as well.
Part of the program tonight, I will air an interview with Dr. Saleh Almani, who will be talking about the council that you just mentioned, and he's a political scientist from King Saud. Back to the topic of the conference, the Saudi and U.S. relations.
Well, that's the issue.
Yeah.
That's precisely the issue. What are our relations? They've been taken granted for 40 years or longer, mostly because Saudi Arabia was almost non-existent as governments when we started. What it had was oil, and our oil companies wanted the oil, and we needed it as a country. And so essentially Saudi Arabia, over that 40 years, went from being a small rural countryside to a very large industrialized base with very well-educated people, matter of 40 years. And our relationships, of course, changed as they came to learn more about the world and learn a little more of their leverage in the world because of the oil they had. They began to be a little bit more independent, and at the same time, we needed them just as much. But 9/11 seemed to suggest that it was going the wrong direction, that, in fact, the government had been a little too permissive when it came to allowing the religious right in that country to encourage people to activist stance in the name of religion, and it seemed to have backfired, reinforced by our support for them doing this, for fighting the Russians in Afghanistan. It's a long story. All of these things crescendoed into this crash in 9/11, literally, in relationships. So we wanted to focus on that specifically. What did they think the relationship should be, and what did we, our faculty, we spoke to, what did we think the relationship should be?
One question I have is with the recent developments in the region and the program, so-called Greater Middle East Initiative,
yeah,
or Reform Initiative, that is on agenda or on table, and basically, from what I put it, is a copy of Helsinki Accord of 70s. To reform the East Bloc and Soviet Union. What is your opinion on that, and how successful do you think that would be? And just to add, from all the news that came after announcement of that initiative, practically most of the countries in the Middle East that were supposed to be targets of this plan, including the Arab League, General Director Amr Moussa, they all somehow denounced it, or they felt that at least it's, there is a big missing part, and that's the security and the issue of Israel-Palestine problem. What is your opinion on that?
Well, their reaction is the same as if, hearkening back to the Cold War days, say the Russians had gotten the edge on us and then issued a demand that we become more socialist. And you can imagine the reaction. There's an emotional reaction to a foreigner telling you how to run your country. That was the initial reaction to Washington's dream of a great reform for the greater Middle East. The nature of it, of course, is entirely Washington's and of this administration, which does think in terms of using the power that seems to be unchallenged, the military power of the United States, to push the world into a shape that best suits the United States. And in some cases, that's not a bad thing. Democracy is not a bad thing. But the motives behind it may be questioned. But that's another story. The reaction of the Middle East is simply that, that they don't want to be told what to do. Saudi Arabia, for example, our subject tonight, has been aware for years that they were going to have to adjust to allow greater citizen participation in their government. There have been increasing pressures for this, and they couldn't put it off any longer. The circumstances meant that they moved a little bit faster right now. But they resent just as much as the rest of the Arab world and the rest of the Middle East. Note, it includes Pakistan, Iran, and all the rest of them. Their reaction is the same, almost. Note, one final point. Morocco and Saudi Arabia alone, maybe Jordan also, amongst the Arab League nations, did say, wait a second, there may be something in these recommendations for reform, for democratization, and so on. They didn't blanket say no. All of them immediately reacted, you know, in anger, though.
Well, have you studied the initiative? Can you briefly
honestly, I have not. I've only seen vague references to it. I haven't seen the actual document, so I don't want to talk about it as such. I only know that the tenor is that of democratization and privatization, which is nothing new in our policies.
Yeah, right. But there are not definitive or clear programs.
As far as I can tell, they aren't. They're simply a call to, frankly, become more like us.
Right.
As I say, that's not necessarily a bad thing, and not all the countries are going to reject it totally. But for their own constituents' sake, they have to reject it and then maybe quietly make reforms.
Okay, you mentioned that in Saudi Arabia already some reform has started, including the Majlis-e Shura and other civil participation. Can you just briefly explain what is the structure of the country in that environment and how citizen participation is actually happening?
Citizen participation right now is not happening except in the traditional fashion, and that's not insignificant, although it's becoming so, by sheer pressure of population growth. There was a time 40 years ago when everyone knew everybody. And if even at the what we would call a state level, they would call the provincial level, the governor of a province could be approached by anyone off the street at least once a week. He had regular sittings, so to speak, and people would line up and offer their problems to him, and he would say, do this, do that, to one of his secretaries, and it would be taken care of. But this only works in a very small world. It does not work in a modern, industrialized, urbanized world that Saudi Arabia is. And as I say, they know that. They don't get enough input, and they're not being efficient in terms of carrying out government policy. So that's, the Majlis-e Shura was the first step. It's all appointive. It was initially 60 members. It's been doubled in size to 120 now. It's made up mostly of what we would call technocrats. There are, as far as I know, no members of the royal family in it. It's entirely what, in the monarchical system, you say, made up of commoners. But they're very well-educated, as you've seen, commoners. There are talks, and they probably will fall through, on having half of that elected in the next 2 years. Mm-hmm. We'll go to elections. And this municipality election that's coming up in October, as a matter of fact, very soon, city councils all over the country, 128 cities, some of them huge like Riyadh, 4.5 million people. It's a lot of responsibility, and that's where they're starting with the electoral reforms. note, women will be voting in this.
Another question regardless of this. I know you have extensive, I guess, knowledge and studies and research on the court system in, mm-hmm. in the region. Can mm-hmm. you tell us what is the court system in Saudi Arabia?
The court
is this a copy of like Ottoman court or is different?
It's like any Islamic court. It's like the courts in Iran, as a matter of fact, although you're using different precedent there.
Right.
It's a court that's based on the Constitution of God, in other words, the Quran. And the Quran is about as vague as our Constitution in most respects, which means that over the hundreds of years that it's been practiced, judges have constantly been making decisions which have been built on, and the law adjusts itself as you go through time, building on effectively precedent. It is not statute law. There is no legislative body involved here, just judges who are extremely well learned in the volumes and volumes of precedent cases and the rest. In that respect, it's not much different than ours. But, of course, the value system is different. In Saudi Arabia, that's the legal system.
Right.
In terms of criminal law, in terms of civil law, commercial law has been modified to accommodate to the Western business practices. Civil and criminal law are still Sharia issues.
Right. Okay. As far as the structure of government,
mm-hmm.
Like ministers and the cabinets and mm-hmm. so on and so forth, they are all appointed by the crown prince now. I guess the king is ill.
The king, de facto king, is Crown Prince Abdullah. The king himself is incapacitated with strokes and the like and really can't do much more than shake hands and carry out minor business. Abdullah's in charge of it. The government as such is, of course, absolute monarchy. The cabinet is made up of all of the ministers, and there's a lot of them. Perhaps a third of them are technocrats. The rest of them are members of the royal family. It's a monopoly by the royal family of power, no question. The judiciary is, in fact, the only independent branch, I should point out, in theory. In theory, any qadi, any judge, is first of all and entirely answerable only to God and to the law, not to the king. But it's rare that one goes against the royal will.
Okay. I guess we are at a point that we can take a short break, and we'll come back and continue this discussion as well as airing the recorded interview with Dr. Almani, and then we will open our phone lines for audience. If they have any question, they can call in at 503-231-8187.